at our desks, and when we get home, more hours in front of the computer or the television. Researchers are finding that our sedentary lifestyle can be hazardous to our health. In fact, the new field of sedentary physiology says that inactivity, maybe even more than diet, is contributing to the obesity epidemic and to the nation's poor health. Well, we begin our discussion by taking a look at the life of our ancestors, the hunters and gatherers, and what they can teach us about evolution and activity. And our guest is Daniel Lieberman. He's a professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard University. And Daniel Lieberman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be with you as well.
Well, let's roll back the clock. How far do we have to go back to get to our hunter-gatherer ancestors?
Well, it's impossible to be absolutely sure of when this style of life began, but probably about 2 to 2.5 million years ago. In Africa, our early ancestors invented this way of life.
And what is this? I think I know, but now I want you to tell us what is this. What is this way of life we're talking about?
Well, it's pretty simple. It's basically every morning you wake up and you wonder what you're going to eat for dinner, and instead of going to a refrigerator or a store, you have to go out and find it. And so it involves a combination of gathering, which means walking around and finding and extracting often foods, such as digging them up or harvesting them, and then supplementing that with hunted foods, such as meat mostly. And then so the combination of that, which involves lots of activity, persisted for millions and millions of years until the evolution of agriculture.
Well, in fact, you say if you look at the human body, that we are built for movement, we are built for locomotion. Walk us through, I guess, our the evolution of the human body, if you would.
Well, it really starts about sometime between about 5 and 7 million years ago, when we diverged from the last common ancestor of humans and chimpanzees, and that was a creature that lived somewhere in Africa, and it was probably something like a chimpanzee in certain ways, though not exactly a chimpanzee. And we became bipeds. And an important thing to know about chimpanzees and gorillas, they're our two closest relatives, is that they're actually not that active during the day. A typical chimpanzee walks about 2 to 3 kilometers a day.
Hmm.
But they're much faster than we are. They have more power and less endurance. But our ancestors, at some point, started to do a lot of walking. And just exactly when that transition occurred and when we became good walkers is a little unclear. But just as a point of reference, a human being, by being bipedal, can actually walk about 4 times as far for the same amount of energy as a chimpanzee.
Oh, interesting.
And that would have helped us move very long distances in more open habitats in order to get food. So early humans, or our early human ancestors, were probably pretty good at walking long distances to forage for nuts and berries and things like that. And that persisted for millions of years until about 2 million years ago, when another set of shifts occurred. And as Africa became drier and more open, then we added running to the mix. And then it's about that time that we see hunting and gathering evolving. And it's a combination of walking long distances, but also running occasionally to hunt, because it's very hard to be an early hunter if you can't run. And that sort of way of life, which has many other features, such as food sharing and division of labor and food processing and various other things that are very important to being human, that persisted for millions of years. But the key thing to note is that hunter-gatherers are active, and we evolved to be active. I mean, an average hunter-gatherer female walks about 9 kilometers a day, and an average hunter-gatherer male will walk about 15 kilometers a day or do some of that by running. That's every single day of your life. That's the average, right? How many of us today walk 9 or 15 kilometers a day? Very few of us.
So we are hunter-gatherers living in a world full of refrigerators and snack machines and soda machines, yes?
Exactly. I mean, if you think about it, there are people today who get up in the morning and maybe they walk a few steps to their garage or the street corner and get on a bus, or more likely get in their car. I think the average American drives 50 kilometers a day. Can get out of your car, take the elevator up to your floor, sit in the desk all day long, and reverse the process on the way home. Getting dinner means basically reaching to the shelf and pulling something off it and sticking it into the oven. You can live your whole day with almost no activity, and until extremely recently, that was impossible. Nobody could do that.
It sounds like you're describing my life in many ways.
Oh, dear.
but nonetheless, I mean, we also evolved into the world that we live in today. I mean, have we sort of beaten evolution or somehow tricked evolution in that we are hunter-gatherers by our physiology, but we live in this world of plenty by comparison?
Well, we do. I mean, people didn't give up hunting and gathering for no reason at all.
Exactly.
Farming offers many advantages. So when farming first evolved after the Ice Age ended, farming gave people the opportunity to have a lot more food, and so farmers started spreading around the globe very rapidly through population growth and migration and expansion, because farmers can have babies at a faster rate than hunter-gatherers. There's a movement out there to sort of demonize farming, but of course farming has lots of advantages, and I think one thing to note about farming is that for most of human history, farming was hard work too. So although farmers can have more kids than hunter-gatherers and live in larger villages and larger populations and do well from a reproductive sense, until the invention of modern farming equipment, farmers also had to work pretty darn hard. So if you look at the physical activity levels of farmers, they're actually up there or sometimes even exceed what hunter-gatherers have to do. It's hard work being a farmer.
So is the message from your research, your work, is that if we take a page from our ancestors, is that we just need to figure out how to be more active to live and to live healthfully in today's world?
Correct. I mean, our bodies are designed by evolution to be very active. And so much of our physiology, even our brain physiology, is dependent on being active. If you want to grow a strong cardiovascular system, you can only do that by stressing the system, right? Mm-hmm. Being inactive results in a weak heart and a weak high blood pressure and a whole range of other problems. Not stressing your skeleton turns you into somebody with low bone mineral density. Not chewing hard food means that you're more likely to have impacted wisdom teeth. Mm-hmm. So it's really literally from our heads to our toes that we require our bodies to work in order to function properly, because that's how they evolved. And we now live in a world in which we don't have to do any more of that, and that's really actually extremely recently. Just the last few hundred years in many respects. And as a result, we have this interesting paradox. On the one hand, we live longer, right? There's no question that there's been some degree of progress. People live longer, and they have much lower chances of dying when we're young, although people often exaggerate hunter-gatherer mortality.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, they're not so bad off after all.
Oh,
but on the other hand, we have disabilities and diseases that never existed before, or only at tiny levels. I mean, rates of obesity and cancer and osteoporosis and diabetes. These are basically unheard of among hunter gatherers, and much less common among early farmers because of exercise.
Do you think it's exercise more than diet or a combination of our lack of activity and then what we eat on top of that?
That's a great question. I'm not really an expert on that, but the more I read and the more I study the problem, the more I think that exercise is more of an important problem than diet. I think we too often demonize diet, partly because diet is such an easy thing to fix, right?
Sure.
You have to change what you put in your mouth, and we just love trying to solve things by stuff we put through our mouths.
Although apparently it doesn't work very well, diets.
No, it doesn't, right. but if you look at the data, Americans do eat too much. Many Americans do eat too much, but it's not actually that much more than what our ancestors ate, based on various guesses and estimates and studies of hunter-gatherers in the wild. If you look at the data, really, what strikes me as being much more different is exercise. Mm. people today, there's something called the physical activity level, which I'm sure your next guest will talk about. But there are a lot of people who live lives in which their physical activity level, which is the ratio of how much energy you expend relative to how much energy, the basic amount of energy your body needs when you're essentially asleep, that ratio in many people today is so low as to be essentially sedentary. And yet, for most of human history, people had much higher ratios of physical activity. And as a result, obesity was much more rare. In the Paleolithic, it was probably, you might live your entire life and never meet an obese, let alone an overweight human being.
So is your message that we need to run, we need to walk, we need to get up and down, we need to take stairs and not elevators or escalators? Is it, we just need to be more active in our lives?
We evolved to be endurance athletes. And if you don't participate in endurance, you inevitably pay a price. Now, the thing is that we didn't evolve to like this. I mean, I think that's one of the important things to remember, right? A hunter-gatherer doesn't get up in the morning and think, oh, I'm going to run a marathon today because that's fun, right? It's not a choice. It's a necessity to work every day when there are no stores and no farms. So life, until very recently, involved regular labor every single day of your life. And so there was no selection to make us enjoy going out and walking 9 to 15 kilometers a day, although I think one can and, of course, does enjoy it. And there are many physical and emotional benefits from exercise. But today we live in a world where we don't have to do that anymore. And we have to realize and take note of the fact that it's a choice. It's a choice that we have to make, and we have to make also for our children. Because it's natural to want to hang around and not do anything. That's sensible from an evolutionary perspective, to save energy when you don't need to use it. So we need to... people need to have this information about just what the human body is designed for, what it's adapted for, and just how potent exercise is as a form of medicine. Exercise has incredible effects on not only on obvious factors like obesity, but also the sequelae of obesity, which include cancer and diabetes and other metabolic diseases. Exercise is completely vital for brain function. There's many studies which show that depression, anxiety, even intelligence and memory are strongly affected by exercise, and all of this makes sense in an evolutionary perspective. This is not a fluke. It's not an accident that exercise is important for our health. It's because of our evolutionary history.
Well, you have done a perfect setup for our show and for our second guest as well. And Daniel Lieberman, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's a professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard University. And James Levine is waiting in the wings. He's a researcher. In fact, he studied the effects of inactivity on health. We will continue our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The Mann Center supports WHYY and presents the Philadelphia Orchestra in three performances. June 28th, the orchestra performs Carl Orff's Carmina Burana. June 29th is an all Tchaikovsky evening featuring the 1812 Overture with fireworks. June 30th is Down the Abbey Road, reimagining the Beatles' iconic album. Tickets for Philadelphia Orchestra performances and the entire summer season at the Mann available at manncenter.org or 215-893-1999.
Teens interested in journalism can use WHYY's production equipment to create news stories based on their interests during the Young Journalist Summer Camp. And for budding young filmmakers, the WHYY Film Academy teaches students to produce their own short films from script to screen. Learn from professionals. Express your ideas. Both camps are for students currently in 9th to 12th grade. Learn more at whyy.org/HamiltonCommons or 215-351-0511.
Father's Day is this Sunday, and yes, we're going to get the big guy a tie, but Tell Me More is celebrating dads in a different way.
I am happiest when my wife and my two daughters are around me. I still feel like I'm steering a ship, but we have reached a much safer place.
The latest in our series of essays on fatherhood, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We are talking about our sedentary lifestyle. And joining us now is James Levine. He's a researcher at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He studies the effects of inactivity on health, and he's the author of a book called Move a Little, Lose a Lot. New NEAT science reveals how to be thinner, happier, and smarter. And NEAT stands for non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which we will be talking about. And James Levine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. How are you this morning?
I'm very well. How are you?
Fantastic. Thank you. What a wonderful discussion with Professor Lieberman. It is intriguing when one puts all of this in a global perspective.
Well, that's why we invited you both to be guests on Radio Times. So let me just give out that phone number to our listeners, and it's 1-888-477-9499. I'm curious how you got interested in this whole field of inactivity.
Well,
is there a short
really
answer?
Like to know, here's the answer. When I was about nine, for reasons I cannot begin to explain to you, what I did in my bedroom was build these large glass tanks upon which I'd place pond snails. And every half an hour during the night, I'd wake myself up with my alarm clock and mark with an X where the snail had moved to. Because I was absolutely convinced that snail Brenda, so to speak, and I did have, of course, names for each of them based upon their shell markings, would always move in the same way each and every night, whereas snail Frank, on the other hand, would always move in a different way and be consistent in that way, in that fashion. And so for some bizarre reason as a child, I'd sort of fashioned this notion that biological entities have a preset amount of motion, have a programmed way in which they move. And that's where it all started.
Well, that's a wonderful story, and what an enterprising young scientist you were, because it's a perfect segue into some of the research that you have been doing, looking at research subjects, I guess, people who come in to try to figure out the effect of calorie intake and energy output and that effect on weight gain or not. But let me just backtrack just a little bit, and I want you to explain to our listeners some of the materials, I guess, that you use. There's something called a BOD pod. What is that?
This is an easy technology to carry around in one's mind throughout the day, is air displacement plethysmography. You can understand why the term BOD pod has become popular.
Yes.
And what it does is enables us to measure the density of the human body. By assessing human density, we're able to get a sense of the body composition, and it's sort of the notion that oil floats, therefore body fat is less dense than water. On the other hand, bone sinks, therefore body muscle and bone is heavier than water. And so the density of the human allows us to assess body composition. There are other techniques, of course, as well. And we use X-ray absorptiometry, and we also use MRI, actually, to assess not only the components of the human body with respect to fat, muscle, and bone, and water, but also to get an understanding of how body fat is distributed across the human, because the evidence is that body fat distribution appears to be critically important in the metabolic health risks associated with obesity.
Oh, that's interesting, and I do want to get to that, and all this is leading up to your research. There's also this thing called the magic underwear.
Yes, I never conceived during multiple episodes of career counseling at high school that underwear design would become the means by which I earned my income, but it transpires that that is so. What we were trying to get at is, if one thinks about all the things one does during the day, whether it be hunter-gathering or playing video games, what immediately one appreciates is that the human does, like, literally a million different things. So apart from following people around, and we did do those studies, actually, in the Ivory Coast, where we literally followed adults and children around for 7 days on end with trained followers and writing down every single thing they did every 15 minutes. However, those kind of studies are simply not practical in the United States. You know, the term uses stalking, of course.
Of course.
And so what we needed to do was to come up with some kind of technological solution that wasn't so invasive as to be sort of video capturing what people were doing throughout their days, but on the other hand, enabled us to get an insight as to how real people move throughout their day. And it transpires after, as you might imagine, decades of careful research, that humans tend to wear their underwear throughout the day. And so by attaching a series of sensors to people's underwear, we were able to start to gain a hidden insight into the actions of the human being.
And what did you find? And this is based on some research where the research subjects were, in a sense, in a controlled environment, and you began to increase their calorie intake. And what did you find?
We were absolutely intrigued by the idea that, and we all know these people, and I think most of us despise them. They appear to be able to eat whatever they like and never gain a single ounce in weight.
Yes, we do know some people.
Yes,
like
that. Yes, we all know people like
them.
That. And we were intrigued as to how they do it. And so what we did is we took a group of non-obese, lean individuals, and we worked out on our research center exactly how many calories each of these individuals required to keep their body weight stable. We were able to do that by providing all the food, carefully measuring body composition, as we were just discussing, and then adjusting caloric intake to work out exactly how many calories a person requires for weight maintenance. Then what we did is we overfed each of those individuals by 1,000 calories excess above their weight maintenance needs.
That's so a lot of calories.
Yeah, 1,000 calories, piece of cake, actually, or should I say several pieces of cake. Simply, you know, just to put that in perspective, Mrs. Smith, for example, might be consuming 3,200 calories a day. During the overfeeding phase, she'd be consuming 4,200 calories. And I will tell you, piece of cake or not, it actually is quite simple. It isn't that difficult to overfeed human subjects.
That doesn't surprise me.
It's very interesting when one thinks about it. Again, thinking back to what Dr. Lieberman was talking about, the idea that all of a sudden we have food available to us in excess, and yet as humans we have the capacity to overeat with ease. Anyway, so we overfed a group of lean individuals by 1,000 calories excess above their weight maintenance needs. And what we found was that some people literally take every extra crumb of cake and deposit it in their body fat stores. They gain fat very, very readily. And in evolutionary terms, these would be very efficient fuel storers, so to speak. Conversely, and relevant, of course, to the obesity epidemic, another group of individuals have the capacity to literally burn off all of those 1,000 excess calories. It's almost as if they rev up their engines to dissipate the excess energy. And how do they do that? The way they do that is somehow, almost magically if you like, they precipitate a significant change in their NEAT, their non-exercise, their daily activities. And exactly how they do that, no one knows. We've been investigating the brain mechanisms that may explain that. But nonetheless, what humans actually do, and several studies have now shown the same thing, is that when you overfeed a human, they increase their non-exercise activity thermogenesis, their daily movements, and they burn off those excess calories. And that's how, astonishingly, in this obesogenic environment, just under half the population has somehow remained thin.
Well, let me take that apart. And what you're saying is that for these research subjects, some of them gained a lot of weight, and one can imagine with 1,000 additional calories every day that would be relatively easy to do. But there were those who didn't, and literally their, what, small movement activity level was maybe unconsciously increased so that they actually were burning off these calories?
That is exactly right.
Wow.
And again, just again to reflect this back into the sort of the scientific domain, is when we then went into the laboratory and asked the question, well, how on earth can it be that when you, if you like, overfeed a human, somehow unconsciously they increase their movement? There has to be, if one thinks about it, a brain mechanism to potentially explain the link between the calories coming in and the calories the body is expending. And we went on a hunt for that. And what we found was that there is a part in the hypothalamus, it's smaller than a period on a page, called the paraventricular nucleus, the PVN, where if one injects certain stimulants, certain arousal proteins, the animal literally turns on its non-exercise activity thermogenesis and, if you like, scurries around the cage like crazy until the effects of the chemical wear off. And so there are several of these proteins now being identified, neuropeptide Y, orexin, and so on and so forth. And what it seems to suggest is that there are indeed mechanisms right at the core of the brain, right in the primal areas in evolutionary terms of the brain's development, that are balancing continuously the calories that we're able to gather, whether that's on the drive-through or by agriculture, linked to the movements we make to expend those calories. And those links are self-evidently, it's just fascinating. I mean, it completely changes your next visit to the coffee store, Marty, because as you're sitting there and watching people, you'll see there'll be a group of people who very quietly are sitting, drinking their coffee or their tea, you know, munching on their muffin. However, there'll be a group of other people who are frenetically bouncing up and down. One forgot the sugar, one forgot the stirrer, one needs to borrow a newspaper, one needs to go to the bathroom, and so on and so forth. And you get a sense of the huge variability of human motion despite a constant environment.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you and actually open up the lines. James Levine is our guest, and he's a researcher at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, and he studies the effects of inactivity on health. He's been talking about some of his research and some of the very interesting findings. He also wrote a book called Move a Little, Lose a Lot. New NEAT science reveals how to be thinner, happier, and smarter. And again, NEAT stands for non-exercise activity thermogenesis. 1-888-477-9499. So just to break down what you just said, and let's go to that coffee shop. So you might see a group of people sitting there and just sort of very quietly maybe reading and drinking their tea or coffee. And then there's another group where someone might be jiggling their foot. Someone might be going back and forth to get more, you know, to get a stirrer. That all those little mini activities add up to the fact that that person might not gain weight like the more sedentary person does?
That is exactly right. And I'll give you the most amazing example right now.
Okay.
Outside my office, through the window, is a gentleman pacing up and down, talking on a cell phone. He's wearing blue jeans, and he's got a light blue top on. He's pacing up and down. Now, that gentleman could have just as easily taken that phone call at his desk on the telephone. Yet, for whatever reason, he's chosen to take his cell phone and pace up and down, whether it's, you might say, to dispel stress, whether it's just because he fancies moving, whether it's because he was a bit itchy, whatever it is. We would argue, however, that that is part of a centrally driven mechanism, dispelling excess calories, whereas another individual with a different brain patterning, if you like, would be seated taking the same telephone call. So our argument is, as one looks across the orchestra of human movement, we are all carrying different instruments, so to speak. Some of us more prone to be up moving, burning off excess calories. Others far more adept at storing excess calories in body fat.
And is that man thin? The one you're looking at out
the
window?
He's actually most trim, I think one would say.
Well, it almost sounds like then the prescription is, you know, more ants in your pants. I mean, the idea of literally just being more, even if you're sedentary, and like a lot of people, you know, I'm sitting in a chair in front of a microphone, and then I'm going to go back to my desk and sit in a chair in front of my computer, is that if we sort of add more of these, and here I am moving my hands here, add more of these little mini activities, we can mitigate some of the calories that we overeat?
This brings up a key part of not only the research that Professor Liebman and ourselves are doing, but other researchers across the nation, is this interaction of our biology, if you like, our DNA, our genotype, with the environments in which we live. In other words, you may have the most antsy pants, you may have more ants in your pants than anyone else, but if you're working in an organization that necessitates you sitting behind a computer screen all day long, regardless of your itch to move, you're not going to get up and move. Otherwise, unfortunately, you know, your job's going to be jeopardized. Conversely, if one is an agriculturalist working in the banana plantations in Jamaica, and the reason I say that is we've actually conducted studies there, regardless of one's tendency to want to sit and rest, one is going to be up and moving twice as much as even lean people living in the United States. And so it is that interface between our natural urges to be up and moving and the permissive or restrictive environments that permit or stop us that balances the equation, if you like, whereby those people who want to burn off extra calories and inherently would be thin are often squelched, whereby their environments stop them doing that and obesity may result.
And I do want to talk about some potential changes to that environment, but it sounds like you're talking about the difference between activity and exercise, because I think, you know, we're all told to exercise, and we also know that many people don't want to do that. But activity, it seems to me, is something different. Do you see a difference?
Well, this actually is an issue that comes up a lot in our programs. We run a lot of programs across different companies and in different schools. And the first thing I say to people who are going to the gym is, it is brilliant. It is fantastic. It is superb. It is great. However, as all of us know, more than three-quarters of Americans, in fact, far more than that in my patients with obesity, do not go to the gym, do not like going to the gym, may not be able to afford to go to the gym, and actually physiologically cannot tolerate a step class. And so for such individuals, which of course represents the vast majority, for most of us, therefore, interdigitating, slipping walks into our day and throughout our day, whether that's through environments that are encouraging it or whether it's through a tremendous will of our own to be up and move more, it is that combination of inserting activity into our days that is a very powerful option for those of us who can't access a gym or who don't want to.
And we're better.
Interestingly,
yeah, Marky,
let me just add a very interesting point, because this is really one of conjecture. It could be argued, if one thinks about it, that gym going as an entity is almost the biological response for those individuals who have that sort of very organized programming sense, whereby they have to move in a very organized and very aggressive, very sort of exertional way. And so people who are going to the gym are themselves actually responding to the biological cues to be active in a very organized and dramatic way. In other words, they might be, for example, the individuals who were sprinting after the prey bearing their spears. In a similar way, they're sprinting after the exercise classes, sweating like crazy. And so, you know, gym going may be part of this biology, but of course the human being is a moving entity, whether one moves extremely at the gym or whether one moves throughout the day, as we were programmed to do for, 2.5 million years.
And that's James Levine. He's a researcher at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. We are talking about his research into inactivity and health. And again, wrote a book called Move a Little, Lose a Lot. And we have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And after this short break, we will talk about non-exercise activity thermogenesis and treadmill desks. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Abington Friends School, a Quaker college preparatory school from preschool through grade 12. When classes end, summer camp begins. For boys and girls ages 2 to 15, Abington Friends is dedicated to offering memorable, fun-filled summer days on a 50-acre campus in Jenkintown. Older campers can pursue their passions at Camp Endeavor, with choices in the performing arts, athletics, science, and more. Summer camp at Abington Friends. More at www.abingtonfriends.net.
Did you see Stephen Colbert on the Tonys? On the next Fresh Air, Stephen Colbert talks about singing and dancing with a hat and cane in the New York Philharmonic production of Stephen Sondheim's musical Company. The filmed version opens in theaters this week. Of course, we'll also talk about the Colbert Report. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Earthquakes, tsunamis, fires, floods, tornadoes. What's going on? Also, inmates caring for other inmates in the hospice at the Louisiana State Penitentiary. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with researcher Jim Levine about our sedentary lifestyle and his research into both inactivity and activity. And we have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. You invented, I believe, this treadmill desk. Can you tell us how it works?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Many parts of our lives are sort of this juxtaposition between, you know, dreams and dreads. And I would say the treadmill desk is exactly that. The reason we came up with this, it's actually a very simple idea. We've discovered that people with obesity tend to be seated for 2.5 hours, 2.5 hours per day more than lean individuals. Mm-hmm. And we realized, just as we were talking about before, Marty, is that most folks simply don't have 2.5 hours a day to fit in any form of whether it's gym going or protracted walking, whatever it may be. And so we were asking, how could a regular person slip in 2.5 hours of walking-like activity during the day to close the obesity gap associated with non-exercise activity thermogenesis, the sedentary gap, if you like? And so an obvious answer was to interlace walking into the workday. Well, since most people spend most of their workdays behind a computer screen, could we interlace walking with working on a computer?
Hmm.
And our first sort of splash at doing this was to literally go to a rubbish skip, take out a broken patient tray table, you know, one of the ones that sort of go up and down.
Yes.
Put a computer screen on top of a wooden shelf, no more complex than that. Bring in a 2.5-year-old used Sears treadmill, which cost us about $200 in the lab, and we sort of slammed it all together, and I started doing my emails on this sort of computer disused patient table, thing. And all of a sudden, we realized it worked. And we then went with actually a German design company and designed some rather fanciful but quite large treadmill desks, again, utilizing very, very inexpensive equipment. And we tested this in 305 people. And what we found is that people are very adept at answering their email while walking on a treadmill at 1 mile an hour. Anyone can do it. Everyone can get the hang of it in about 2 minutes. And the other amazing discovery was that as people are working whilst walking on a treadmill, they don't actually fall asleep. And so it became clear that one potential mode of working would be to convert the sedentary chair-based computer system to a treadmill-based system. And so early on, and again, I think this is part of the trick of working in science, is we developed a relationship with Steelcase, who very beautifully created a somewhat expensive version of this treadmill desk. Now, what's important about the relationship is they knew what to do in terms of the legalities of putting treadmills in regular offices, what the exact dimensions need to be for a desk in the modern workplace, and so on and so forth. And so that's the blessing. So the blessing was that here we had a true working representation of this idea of walking throughout the workday. The curse, however,
yeah, go ahead.
was, of course, that this was an expensive way of achieving it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, on one hand, everyone wants one. On the other hand, no one can afford one. However, our point is that this is entirely achievable, and it actually does help people move substantially more, particularly those who are suffering with obesity.
So if it's going 1 mile an hour, can you work on a computer? As you said, you can read email. Can you do essentially everything at your desk? You can do standing up and doing this work walking?
Yes. The answer is actually quite simply yes, apart from sleeping, of course. Answering email, writing grants and papers. I've done it all at 1 mile an hour. And in fact, there are very few things that you can't do at 1 mile an hour. And in fact, when you don't want to walk, because of course most people don't want to walk all day long, you stop it. And you either pull up a chair or you sort of stand still and work. And of course, Winston Churchill used to work standing. And so, you know, it is entirely amenable to normal day working practices to be walking whilst working. And probably the most important representation of this beyond the one, Marty, that you mentioned, is the simple idea of having walk and talk meetings. Now, most of us who spend a lot of our days having meetings will tell you that, first of all, most meetings are not that valuable. And I'm being perhaps a little cynical here, you know, but there is a truth to this. However, a walk-and-talk meeting is bilaterally valuable. Both people have an hour of walking. Both people feel healthy at the end of it.
Even if nothing is accomplished in that meeting.
I didn't say that.
No, I hear you. I hear you. And I've been to some of those meetings. Let me get some callers into the conversation. We've got Greg from Phoenixville. And Greg, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I missed probably the first 10 minutes of this of your show, but when I got in the car, the gentleman was talking about people who everybody hates, who no matter how much they eat, don't gain weight.
Right.
And I'm actually that guy.
Are you? We hate
but
you.
The fascinating thing for me is, everything he's talking about is, it's like the more I eat, the more I fidget.
Oh, that's fascinating.
But I have a sister who's a couple of 100 pounds overweight.
Wow.
Who's, you know, and we're kind of very polar opposite in a way, but like I said, my wife has like had this concern for years. It's like, no matter how much I feed you, you won't gain weight. You know, no matter, she's like to the point of like, let me give you junk food to see if it'll make a difference. And all it does is annoy her in the evening if we're watching television or something, because I'm literally can't stop moving my feet.
Oh, that's fascinating. Greg, let me see what Jim Levine says. Jim, go ahead.
Well, Greg, actually, I think it is doubly fascinating. Not only are you that person that others may be envious of, let's put it that way, but it is actually very interesting that you have a sister who appears to have the opposite situation. And as soon as one hears that, one wonders, therefore, whether there isn't quite clearly a gene effect. Certainly, again, being Greg presumptuous for a second, one might argue that you were brought up together, and I hope that isn't presumptuous, but it implies, therefore, certainly that childhood environmental exposure was the same, yet the two of you responded to it very differently. And at the back of one's mind, I don't know if you feel the same, one almost wonders whether there isn't a biology at play to explain why you are so lean and move so much, whereas your sister is in a different situation. What do you think?
Greg, do you think there's some truth to that?
Here's what I would say. I would say it probably is biological. I look like the men on my mother's side of the family. I'm very tall. I'm very thin. I've lost my hair. My sister and my looks like people on my father's side of the family. They're short. They're overweight. You know, and they are actually the farmers. And the family that I come from are very sedentary, you know, but, you know, it's like my uncle who was sat behind a desk his whole life is just as thin and as tall as me.
Oh, that's fascinating.
No matter what he does. But then, like I said, my father's side of the family, everyone is overweight, and they're all farmers.
Well, that's interesting, Greg, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And let me just ask you, Jim, do you think there's some gender difference? Do you think men are more, to use Greg's word, more fidgety than women?
I'll tell you something. Again, we haven't published this, so, again, it's a bit speculative to say that. We went after that question ourselves. We were quite interested by that. And I have to tell you that the answer is no. We couldn't find a specific gender effect that explains why some people appear to be more fidgety than others. But having said that, that is a question we too are interested in, and I would say the jury is still out.
Greg, thanks for the call. Let's see what Charles from Allentown has to say. And Charles, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
When you describe the activities of the people who do the neat activities and burn up extra calories that way by the fidgeting, walking around, moving, standing instead of sitting, it reminded me of some ADHD behavior. And it seems to me that could be a genetic link or a biological link to some of this at any rate.
Well, Charles, that's an interesting question, and frankly, one that I was thinking of as well, Jim, as I was reading some of your research. Do you think there's a connection there?
We've done a lot of work with schools trying to promote activity throughout the school day, either by redesigning the entire school itself or by integrating these kind of movements into classroom activities. We've been challenged actually now on several of the times. Charles, unfortunately, this is another challenge, and I do feel guilty not for specifically designing studies to address this. But we, I must tell you, have seen, if not seven times more, children who are suffering with ADHD on medication do exceedingly well in activity-promoting classrooms. I literally have, of course, teachers, amongst others, emailing me quite frequently with stories such as, we tried an activity-promoting classroom, and you know, Johnny, so to speak, did incredible. You know, Johnny, who previously had ADHD, is doing incredibly well. We've got him a bouncy ball to sit on, or he's allowed to, in one case, use one of these bouncing mini treadmills at the back of the classroom, or an exercise bike. We had one boy in one of our studies who literally didn't need to ask for a bathroom pass. It was understood that every half an hour he would go to a bathroom. And this was in a school redesign. During the redesign, his ADHD-associated activities completely vanished, and his parents, because we provided questionnaires to the parents as well, reported a dramatic change in this young gentleman, and that for the first time in his school career, he was under self-direction, doing his own homework, and was relaxed in the evening and went to bed with ease. I think there is a tremendous opportunity to do work in this area, and I do feel somewhat guilty that we haven't quite got around to doing that yet, but I agree, Charles, 100%.
This is, I think,
something quite important.
Charles, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Albert from Wilmington has to say. And Albert, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to know how the brain itself factors in, because I've read studies about, you know, the brain relatively burning more calories than the body itself, the thought, you know, thinking process.
Well, Jim Levine, can you answer that?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd like to make a quick reflection based on something Daniel Lieberman said earlier, and we don't have good data to this, but no one does to my knowledge. Movement globally affects apparently how we think, how we feel, how we behave, and all of those terms are soft terms and therefore, of course, difficult for us to study. And all of us know, however, that when you've had kind of a bit of a bad day, going for a walk, whether with a friend or by oneself, somehow makes you feel a bit better. And there are voluminous data sets now looking at the power of walking on prevention and in treatment of depression, for instance, and low mood, low affect. And so the link between mood and activity, I think all of us inherently understand to be present, but also studies are hinting at its presence. In the hardcore neuroscience, you have scientists such as Colleen Novak, Kathy Kotz, who are literally taking very, very fine needles and placing them right at the center of animal brains and examining the brain firing, the brain integration between daily movement and caloric intake, to try and tease apart that biology we were discussing earlier, whereby it has to be the case that somehow the brain is sensing all that we're eating and somehow responding to it. But precisely what that mechanism is, no one fully understands, but I can assure you there are large and superb groups of scientists who are investigating precisely that.
And my understanding is you've also been investigating literally just calorie intake, or how much calories we burn, with some really basic things that we do, like chewing or standing or maybe even jiggling our foot, which I tend to do pretty much all day long.
It may have been one of my multiple career errors to have studied chewing gum. Because as a result of publishing a paper about the calories we burn chewing gum, I received so many negative responses, particularly from dentists saying that we're promoting, temporal mandibular dysfunction and so on and so forth. But that was not the point of why we were studying these kind of activities. The point we were trying to make, and chewing gum, as you say, Amati, is a perfect example. We also studied things like sort of just tidying up one's house. We had this one lady who brought in a stuffed cat into the laboratory and kept tripping over it, because that's what happens in her house, apparently. So we studied a lot of these kind of things. And the key point is that even trivial movements, and we'll take chewing gum as the first example.
Go ahead.
Chewing gum, for example, increases your metabolic rate about 5 to 10% above basal, above basal metabolic rate. And so, on the other hand, getting up and folding laundry doubles your metabolic rate, increases metabolic rate 100 to 150%. The point being is all of these activities, all of these movements cumulatively, like putting a dollar into your savings account every week, it adds up. And by doing more and more of these activities, they add up more and more. Conversely, however, as we do less and less, whether that's remote control, driving from the garage straight into the work car park, whether that's sitting behind a computer, as we do less and less, that too adds up, but it adds up against us. And so, on balance, all of these low-grade activities, whether it's chewing gum, folding laundry, or tripping over one's cat, all of these things cumulatively add up to account for very large numbers of calories, and certainly enough to explain obesity and give us hope in seeing its reversal.
Well, it's been really fascinating. Most interesting to talk to you, Jim Levine. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure entirely. Thanks, Martin. Thanks to all the callers, too. Fantastic questions.
And we'll let you get back onto your treadmill there.
I'm starting it this second.
I figured you were. James Levine, a researcher at the Mayo Clinic, he studies the effects of inactivity on health, and he wrote a book called Move a Little, Lose a Lot, New, Neat, N-E-A-T, Science Reveals How to Be Thinner, Happier, and Smarter. And we began our conversation with Daniel Lieberman. He's a professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard University. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes and find out much more about this program. John Knapp, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media.